Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A22-0843, James F. Christie versus Estate of Dylan Christie et al. As you know, we are conducting this oral argument by Zoom today. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer in the grid view that you can see to monitor your time. If we experience any technical difficulties, the marshal will stop the clock and we'll adjust accordingly. Hopefully we will not have any difficulties. To anyone who is viewing the oral argument today, I'll just remind you that an audio recording will be available tomorrow on our website, but we do not allow video recordings except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. Please identify yourself and the party you represent, and please correct me if I've mispronounced the name of your client, and help us with the pronunciation of your name and let us know how you'd like to be addressed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Berger. I am appearing today on behalf of appellant James Christie. This is the third time that this matter has come before this court. The first two times this came before the court focused primarily on the existence and enforceability of a oral contract to transfer land. Unlike those prior proceedings, the primary focus in this appeal relates to a claim by Mr. Christie for unjust enrichment and counterclaims by the respondents to enforce loans that were made during the lifetime of James Christie's parents, Dylan Christie and Dorothy Christie. Specifically, Mr. Christie raises three issues in this appeal. First, whether the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Christie's claim for unjust enrichment. Second, whether the district court's finding that Mr. Christie owes respondents $100,000 for outstanding loans is supported by substantial evidence in the record. And third, whether the district court erred in failing to independently weigh the evidence and make its own factual findings on Mr. Christie's equitable claims for specific performance and unjust enrichment. I'd like to begin with the unjust enrichment claim.
Counsel, just one question right at the outset. It seems to me like, I've handled, I was a trial court judge for 23 years, and I've handled a lot of estate cases, never seen a jury trial in one. The whole procedural posture of this case seems really unusual. Would you agree?
Your Honor, I would certainly agree with that. I do not know all of the background. This appeal is my first involvement in this case. I did not try any of the three trials and do not know what went into all of that procedural posture. I've certainly reviewed the record, but I do not know how we came to this point.
Wouldn't you agree, though, that counsel at the time agreed that the jury could decide all these issues?
Your Honor, I would agree that counsel for James Christie had proposed a jury on the equitable claims. Under the rule, that is not sufficient. The rule requires that for an equitable claim, a jury would be considered advisory unless both sides agree to a binding jury. And in this case, the respondents objected and did not agree to the binding nature of a jury finding. And therefore, the jury was advisory. And
Mr. Berger, was the argument regarding Rule 39.02 raised by appellant before the district court, by your client?
It was not, Your Honor, because the issue did not come up until after the jury came back with its verdict and after the court issued findings without independently weighing the evidence. So it was not an issue.
But it could have been discussed when there was a discussion about having the jury, whether these issues should be decided by the jury or the judge, correct?
Your Honor, I believe it could have been. There's no indication in the transcript that it was.
So why isn't that argument forfeited before this court?
Your Honor,
it wasn't raised below.
Your Honor, it's not forfeited because the issue did not arise until post-trial when the judge issued its findings of fact. The forfeiture rules apply to issues such as objections to evidence being introduced that occurred during the trial, not to things that arise for the first time post-trial.
Are you sure that Thiel v. Stitch is as limited as you're arguing? I think the case that you rely on is pretty specific in terms of whether it addressed whether you needed to make a motion for a new trial in regards to when there had been a motion in limine, and those motion in limine issues were already fully briefed and argued. So I guess what I'm thinking is there's a distinction here because the Rule 39.02 issue wasn't briefed and argued to the district court. So why wouldn't the LV Stitch preclude you from raising it on appeal?
Your Honor, the rationale for requiring post-trial motions or risking forfeiture is that in the heat of a trial, a district court judge may make a mistake, and to raise those issues to allow the judge to correct those mistakes. The same rationale that underlines Thiel v. Stitch, doesn't apply when it's the district court issuing a written order post-trial, when you're not in that moment, when it's not that type of a trial decision. And so I'm not aware of a case directly on point on this, but I believe the language of the case law combined with the underlying rationale for that rule would support that an issue is not forfeited where it arises for the first time post-trial based on the district court's order.
Counsel, I guess outside of the Thiel case, my question is why isn't this invited error when you admitted that your client asked for this to be submitted to the jury? Your client didn't object to any of the jury instructions. There was never any indication pre-trial that this was going to be an advisory jury. Why isn't this precluded by the invited error doctrine?
Your Honor, it's not precluded by the invited error doctrine because of the clear condition in the rule of both parties agreeing. And I think that requirement is needed because absent that clear rule of both parties agreeing in advance, respondents in this case would be put in a position of being able to sit back and decide whether they like the jury or not. And as in this case, if the jury comes back in their favor, they can say, well, that's now binding, even though we objected before.
Whereas did respondents object to the unjust enrichment claim being submitted to the jury?
Your Honor, my recollection of the transcript from the hearings at the trial and pretrial were that they objected to the binding jury on all of the equitable claims, which would include the unjust enrichment. Unless there's more questions on that topic, I would like to turn to the unjust enrichment claim, which I think is the most significant error in this case. The unjust enrichment standard is certainly broad, but it's also certainly well-defined and longstanding in Minnesota law. And that doctrine is intended to allow somebody to recover where the other party has received the benefit of money that in good conscience they should not be permitted to retain. This goes back to the 1800s, and there is clear case law throughout the time period indicating that the focus is not on the person who paid the money, who gave up the benefit. The focus is on the party who received the benefit and whether it is just and equitable for them to retain that benefit. And in fact, the restatement of third of restitution specifically addresses what happened here, which was Mr. Christie making payments on a loan that he did not know for the benefit of his parents and that ultimately benefited the estate based on his understanding of an enforceable oral contract that he would get this land back at the end. And on that point, I think the facts here are largely undisputed as it relates to that. There's no dispute that on January 15th, 2004, James Christie transferred this farmland to his parents, that the land was worth $1.2 to $1.3 million, and that in exchange for transferring this land, James received only $550,000 of benefit. There's no dispute that his parents, Dillman and Dorothy, took out a loan from AgStar Financial Services to finance that transaction, that that loan was secured by a mortgage on the very farmland that James had transferred to them, and that James was not a borrower or a guarantee on that loan. Thus, absent the oral agreement that James believed existed, he had no obligation to pay that loan. That was an obligation of his parents. There is no dispute in the record that between November 27th, 2007 and January 25th, 2011, James made at least 45 separate principal payments on his parents' loan, totaling at least $174,550.45. There is also no dispute that in May 2012, James Christie made additional principal payment of $295,277.17 and an interest payment of $4,714.48. In other words, all of those undisputed facts lead to the inescapable conclusion that respondents have received the benefit of at least $474,542.10 in payments from James Christie that but for the oral agreement, he would not have had any obligation to repay. Now, looking
so at- you would agree though that because this there was a jury verdict that on the special verdict form, the jury found that respondents did not receive something of value from appellant to which they were not entitled, and that appellant did not prove that he had an oral contract. You're not disputing the jury's finding that there wasn't an oral contract, correct?
Your Honor, I think the jury's finding on the oral contract is more nuanced than that it didn't exist. I think what the jury found.
No, right. I mean, I didn't read the full finding, but you're not disputing the finding that the jury made relating to the oral contract, correct?
That is correct.
So you're disputing the jury's finding that respondents didn't receive something of value from appellant to which they were not entitled.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you'd agree that we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, consider the jury's verdict in that light?
Your Honor, I believe that depends on whether the jury was binding or advisory. If the jury was binding, then that would be the standard. If it was advisory, this is an equitable claim that the court takes a look at, and it would be a abuse of discretion standard. But I want to touch on that nuance a bit, and that was actually the next point I was going to get to, because I think it's significant. We had one jury look at these facts and find by a preponderance of the evidence that the oral contract actually existed. The most recent jury looked at it and said that the oral contract was not established by clear and convincing evidence, and therefore is not enforceable. So I think the only way to look at the totality of the jury findings in this case is that by a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, the oral contract existed, but it's not enforceable under the statute of frauds. And I think that's significant to the only explanation that respondents have given of why they should retain the money. And it's not even about retaining the money. It's James Christie was somehow wrong to pay it because this was a lawyer's concoction. I believe his respondent's terminology. A jury looked at these facts and concluded that by a preponderance of the evidence, the contract existed. I don't think it was unreasonable for Mr. Christie to rely on legal advice based on the totality of the history here. It was ultimately found to be unenforceable, and we're not challenging that, but it wasn't unreasonable. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berger. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel and Ms. Seehusen, who is the personal representative for the estate. The first thing I would point the court to, and the court is already obviously very focused
on. Can you please, sorry to interrupt, can you please introduce yourself for the purposes of the recording and identify the party you represent?
Sure. My name is Ken Schuler. I'm an attorney in Rochester, and I represent the respondents. The standard of review is laid out in our brief, and the standard of review is the only question for questions for review are whether the evidence sustains the findings of fact and whether such findings of fact sustain the conclusions of law and judgment. As we pointed out and has already come up today, I think the seminal issue is whether the arguments that are raised on appeal have been forfeited. We've cited the court to the, I pronounce it Teely, just because I knew a guy in Owatonna who was named Teely, the Teely case, and other precedent that I think establishes clearly that these issues needed to be raised at the district court level in order to preserve them for appeal. They were not raised at the district court level. Therefore, those arguments are forfeited.
Regard to that point, can you address appellant's argument in appellant's reply brief based on Souter and the County of Hennepin v. Bakta case? I think he's essentially arguing that only Thiel v. Stitch only applies to arguments that, issues that arose during the course of trial.
And I do not read the holding in Thiel or Teely in the way that he does. I think the whole purpose of the rule is that if you want to raise an issue, you not only have to raise it during trial, but you'd also have to raise it in post-trial motion as well. And that's a decision they made. They didn't raise it there. And that the scope of the requirement that issues be presented at the district court level requires or includes the obligation to make post-trial motions, to raise those objections and not to bring them up for the first time on appeal. The unjust enrichment claim was hotly contested in the third trial. I actually was trial counsel for all three cases and have a pretty good history over the past almost 10 years. Actually, it is 10 years now of what occurred in each trial and the circumstances relating to that. But the court gave an instruction regarding what unjust enrichment means. It truly was a jury question here. And the court can see in our memorandum, and also you can read my closing argument in the case as to why I did not feel the elements of unjust enrichment had been met, and also why it is that there were certain financial considerations that James Christie was not letting the jury know about. Fundamentally, what they were trying to argue and are still attempting to argue is he just gets an automatic unjust enrichment recovery for any money that he applied toward the mortgage. And that's not the way it works. That's not the way the law works. That's not what the facts are in the case. He had actually received substantial financial benefits as a result of continuing to operate that property, which were properly set off against any unjust enrichment claim. I detailed all of that to the jury. And also, he was committing tax fraud. He admitted
to
that.
But he was paying, but he was paying rent for leasing the property, for getting those financial benefits, correct? I mean, the record's pretty clear on that.
Well, no, well, he paid rent to them, but then he re-leased it at a higher amount. And so that's when I told the jury about that, he was taking the cream. So for example, I don't remember the exact amount of rent he was paying to his parents. It was some nominal amount, call it $100. I don't remember exactly what it was. And so I think in 2011 and 2012, he had re-leased it to a farmer named Tom Vavra for $425, and he pocketed that difference.
And well, but the question in an unjust enrichment claim is not really focused on the plaintiff's conduct. It's more focused on the defendant's receipt of the money as opposed to the plaintiff's motives. I mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because it seems like a lot of your argument is more focused on the plaintiff's motives related to the taxes, but really in an unjust enrichment claim, aren't we supposed to look at, did the defendant receive something that they were not entitled to? It's not really a focus on the plaintiff.
Yeah, and the jury instruction that was used here was failure of consideration, fraud on our part. There was no fraud or a mistake. There was no mistake on our part, or a situation where it would be morally wrong. And there was no moral issue that would allow for, or we didn't do anything morally wrong. And
well, so, I mean, so here's my question, because I do think that the unjust enrichment claim comes down to, I mean, you don't disagree that the estate received a $1.2 million property for $500,000 or 500 and whatever the amount is, correct?
I understand that you're talking about the original transaction back in the early 2000s. Yeah, there had been some equity. James had defaulted on the loan, and we took in, we went in and we purchased that property and
for less than half of its value.
Well, that's what they argued. We took on the risk that that land may not have that value, that actually you could have depreciation in value.
Council, what's an acre of farmland worth today in Olmsted County?
It depends. I've seen prices anywhere from, you're talking tiled tillable land?
Yeah.
Anywhere
from— Is that what this is? Isn't that what this is? Or a lot of it is?
This is tiled tillable land.
Right.
This past year, and actually I'm litigating that in two other cases right now, it'd be anywhere from $8,000 to $18,000, depending on the quality of the land. However, with the prime rate increases, you're about to see those values drop dramatically.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty confident of that. We're heavily litigating that right now in Waseca.
Farmers buying land usually deal in cash, in my experience, but. Oops, we locked you up somehow.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes, now.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I it would be a poor investment right now, I think, if you bought some land for, say, 12,000 acres.
12,000, okay.
Yeah, just throwing that out as an example.
But that's kind of a common number in southern Minnesota right now, isn't it?
It has been, and it's been high for several years. But like I say, you talk to any banker down here, they're going to tell you that it's not going to stay up that high this next year. Okay.
But I mean, I guess my question was the value of the land at the time the estate received it. They received the land for half of what it was worth at the time that the transfer occurred. I mean, that's shown in the record, correct?
Well, I mean, there's an appraisal at that time. There likely was equity in that land at that time.
And so then post that, I mean, the record is pretty clear that then James was paying payments on the mortgage. So now he's transferred the property for less than half the value. And then James is paying mortgage payments that the estate is benefiting from on top of the fact that they received this land for less than half of what the value was in 2004 when the transfer happened.
Yeah, James also testified that he understood that his parents had the full right and freedom to transfer the land as they deemed fit. And there was also a 2011 will where the parents definitely treated the land as their own and gave James no credit whatsoever for any payments he had paid toward the mortgage. When you look at the options that were granted in the 2011 will, there were also financial transactions that were going on between James and in particular his dad, Dillman. And one of the tragedies we had in this case is that Dillman Christie was dead. And so we had huge issues with hearsay in the case. Also keep in mind, James Christie had a ledger and he destroyed the ledger. So we were never allowed to see exactly what was going on financially between he and his dad. And the jury was allowed to hear about that. And we knew that there were other transactions because we did at least have one ledger. So there was all kinds of game playing that was going on.
But again, I mean, I feel like your argument is very focused on the plaintiff's conduct when in unjust enrichment, the focus is supposed to be on whether the estate has received something that they didn't get, that they shouldn't have received. And the reality for me, I guess, when I look at the record is that the estate is getting this land free and clear of the mortgage. And they've found that there is no contract. So the estate is going to get 100% of the land for essentially free.
Well, we didn't get, I'm sorry, Judge.
No, go ahead.
We didn't get $232,000 of rent money that should have come our way. We didn't get the 2012 rent.
But that's a separate claim that the jury made different findings on. I'm focused on the unjust enrichment claim itself.
Right. And unjust enrichment, you can argue about whether it remains an equitable claim. It certainly started as an equitable claim. To receive equity, you must do equity. And the jury is looking at the totality of circumstances here, and they're looking at these specific financial setoffs that we're describing for them. Plus, we're looking at the fact that we've got destroyed evidence, and they're looking at this, and obviously they're concluding that there's big time game playing that's going on here. There are transactions that are not being disclosed to us. We know of specific financial setoffs that we think should apply toward this, and we know what the wills say. Both back in 2004, the codicils to the wills, and the 2011 will, we know what those wills say. So there was clearly no intent by the parents to give any credit to James for anything he had done financially in the past. Also keep in mind that that last payment of $300,000 is after Dillman Christie is mentally incapacitated, is eating his own feces. And I won't go back into all the issues that were going on with that have been resolved. And it's after James has consulted with a lawyer that the lawyer's trust account pops up with this $300,000. And I could go into all of the game playing that went on with trying to establish this assertion that there was an oral agreement to convey real estate and the part performance exception and all the efforts done to set up that claim in the case. And so the jury was presented with this. Joe Jopat tried this case three times. And Judge Opat, once the jury verdict was read, immediately adopted the jury's determination in this case. If anyone knew exactly what was going on here and what was appropriate for unjust enrichment, it was Judge Opat. And it seems to me that if one wanted to challenge why he did what he did, you should bring it back to him. And you didn't do that with any type of post-trial motion. This was, as counsel said, it was a nuanced argument with respect to unjust enrichment. There were a lot of moving parts there. And I think if I could just sit down with you for about 20 or 30 minutes, I could really explain to you why this is an appropriate verdict by the jury. But I think you're compelled by the standard of review and also by the fact that there's forfeiture here to conclude that this unjust enrichment claim was properly determined by the jury. Or I think maybe a better way to put it is there is an evidentiary basis for why the jury did what it did, and that we're not getting something for nothing here.
Just a little off the topic, but
yeah,
can you explain why when the Supreme Court only reversed really a small part of the case, whether there was an oral contract that overcame the statute of frauds, or why were all these other issues thrown back in? I mean, it seems like the parties had plenty of time to address those in the earlier proceedings, and it seems like it's just becoming a waste of the court's and the jury's time on the third time around.
Well, if we had a little more time, I could explain to you the history of what happened with the first trial and the unjust enrichment claim there and why we did what we did in the second trial. The idea for bringing all these issues back in came from opposing counsel. He shot me an email and he said, all these four stipulations we had before, we no longer have stipulations on those. And I looked at that and I said, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and try that. That issue was vetted at the pretrial. It was also vetted fully prior to starting the trial. And it was clear that they wanted to go ahead and go back into these issues. And that's what we did. So it was the appellant who chose to do this. It was not us. And I guess you'd have to ask them exactly what their motivation was at that point. I see I'm out of time.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Schuller? All right. Thank you. For your argument, counsel for appellant, Mr. Berger, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's probably an aside, but on the land prices, I recently heard of a sale in Northwest Iowa at $30,000 an acre. So I think a lot of people would jump at $12,000 an acre. The main things I wanted to touch on are, number one, the suggestion of that James Christie destroyed this ledger. There is simply no evidence in the record that the ledger was intentionally destroyed. There is evidence in the record that it was lost and no longer existed, but there's no evidence in the record of what happened to it. So I think the implication that evidence was destroyed is unwarranted and unsupported by the record. On the unjust enrichment claim, at the end of the day, the question of whether the evidence supports any finding after a trial, judge or jury, is not forfeited when raised on appeal. That is the nature of a post-trial appeal. You can argue that the evidence did not support the findings and the judgment. Respondents concede.
But just to be clear, in your brief, you argue, you're arguing that the district court should have decided. Clarify for me exactly what you're arguing with regard to unjust enrichment.
Your Honor, we argue that the district court should have made independent findings because unjust enrichment is an equitable claim. Even if I lose on that issue here, even if you find against me, we are still entitled to appeal and argue, as we do, that the evidence does not support the findings on the unjust enrichment claim. So even if I'm wrong on
the jury's findings, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
even if I'm wrong, we're still entitled to challenge whether the evidence supports the findings. And in this case, there is simply nowhere in the trial transcript, in the briefs, in Mr. Schuler's argument today, nowhere is there any explanation of why the estate should get the benefit of all of this land for free. And that's essentially what is
happening. Well, I think respondent's argument is that part of the jury has made some credibility determinations that there have been some offsets and that your client received benefits for the fact that he was making some of these payments, and that supports in the record that the estate isn't being unjustly enriched by the mortgage getting paid. I guess, what's your response to that?
Your Honor, number one, I don't think that that is supported by the record. But number two, the evidence is clear that James Christie leased the land back from his parents and paid to his parents the agreed upon rent to lease that land. Once he leases that land, that lease gives him the right to do with it whatever he wants, whether he wants to farm it himself, whether he wants to sublet it out if he can make more money doing that. Once he leases it, it's his right to do with it as he pleases during the term of the lease. And there's no dispute in the evidence that he leased the land and that he paid the rent. And after that, if he was able to, as he was, sublease it and make more money, the estate and his parents don't have any claim on that. Their claim was to the rent that he did pay. That is not an offset. That was not anything that they were entitled to receive. The fact of the matter is these payments were made over time. The ultimate outcome of the findings would be the estate receiving all of this land for free. This is the quintessential situation of unjust enrichment. I would like to touch real briefly, I see I have 30 to 40 seconds, on the counterclaim. I briefed this. The court looks at the record. The respondents had the burden of proof. Their own witness acknowledged that his document upon which they based their claim was incomplete as far as missing payments that were evidenced, and stopped at a date and didn't include payments that were made after that. So again, based on those admissions that are clear in the record, they cannot meet their burden to establish the claims in anything more than $15,000, which Mr. Christie admitted. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to counsel for your arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, Your Honor.